Welcome back, movie fans. This is the podcast Sequels Suck, and tonight we have a movie that was kind of set at Christmas, just like its first one. It's a sequel that I thought we'll bring some of the characters back, and we'll also set at Christmas again. And we are talking about Die Hard 2, or Die Harder, as some people refer to it as, and I'm pretty sure some of the posters had the 1990 sequel to Die Hard. Angus.
Hey, how's it going? Good to see you guys. Lovely, lovely to be here. Lovely to see you all again. Good job remembering to say people's names this episode, because I didn't last episode. So, good introducing. Well, you've introduced me. Hi, yeah. I'm Angus.
And how are you, Michelle? And it's good to see you got into the theme. You've got a bit of a white background. You've got the white Christmas tree as well. Christmas shirt. Oh, wow. Yeah, I actually had a Nakatomi Plaza shirt somewhere, but just couldn't find it, and it doesn't really – it's the sequel anyway, so.
It's questionably a Christmas movie, this one. The first one would be, but this one, I don't know.
But at the end of the day, like, the argument can be made. I'm not going to fight anyone on it, don't get me wrong, but, I mean, it's, again, Die Hard again. It's John McClane, and it is happening at Christmas time, and a lot of people are at the airport because it's Christmas. So,
This is a good jump off point, because this is a conversation slash argument I've been having with a lot of people in the last couple of weeks about Christmas movies and things like that. And is it, what makes a Christmas movie? Like, is it a Christmas movie just because it happens around Christmas time, or is it a Christmas movie because it has something to do with Christmas? Like, does Christmas have to be a part of the plot? And I think I fall into the camp where I argue for it to be a Christmas movie, Christmas is, it's got to have something to do with the plot, in my opinion. You know, like, for example, Jingle All the Way. That's a Christmas movie. Like, it's all about a dad trying to get a present for his son for Christmas. Santa Claus, no brainer. The guy becomes goddamn Santa Claus. But then you get into those gray areas where, like, Die Hard, it's a Christmas party, but that's not why those guys are robbing the place. Whereas, like, Home Alone 2, they're robbing the toy store because it's Christmas Eve. So it's, you know, I look, this is just my own brain doing its own thing, you know, in its spare time. But that is where I think I've landed. What about you guys? What do you think about Christmas movies? What makes a Christmas movie for you, Michelle?
I'm pretty sure I just watched a New Year's Eve themed movie, but there was Christmas trees in it, so I added it to my 25 days of Christmas. So,
a New Year's Eve movie?
Well, it was set on, like, New Year's, but it still had a Christmas vibe to it.
And they said a vibe, but there's Christmas trees.
There was Christmas trees because it's like a week until New Year's. You sent it to me. It was that About Fate or whatever it was called.
And I sent it?
Yeah, you sent it to me on Instagram.
Okay.
The Emma Roberts movie.
Yeah, I feel like I'm getting thrown under the bus.
No, you did. You did post about that movie. You
did. Well, only because it was Emma Roberts.
That's it.
Let's be honest.
I don't think anyone knows that movie exists except for you. So if you're putting it out there, you're creating this vibe. Where do you fall with it, Cable? What makes a Christmas movie?
Oh, look, I probably agree with you. I think there has to be something to do with, I guess, the spirit of Christmas, Santa Claus. It has to be part of the plot. I think that's why I know. I can't even remember if it was verbally or it was in a chat with Sean. Sean got really upset about when I even kind of contemplated not having a fight about Die Hard being a Christmas movie. I've always said it's a Christmas movie, and I like to say, stir people up and say, yeah, of course it's a Christmas movie. But it's set at Christmas, and there's a lot of little Christmassy mentions and stuff that happens within Die Hard. But you could easily remove that stuff, and I don't think it changes a hell of a lot. I think it helps with some of the setup in Die Hard and even this movie again, because it raises the stakes, because it puts a lot more people in peril because they're all in a particular place, because they're all, like, whether it's the airport and being on the planes because a lot of people are traveling, trying to get to loved ones and get to places for Christmas. Same thing, Nakatomi is a Christmas party. It's putting a lot of people in the one place at the one time, but doesn't need to be Christmas. That could have easily been replaced with Nakatomi, you know, the head honcho retiring and them having a party. It didn't need to be necessarily at Christmas. So,
it could have been an Easter movie.
Yeah, so there's definitely, I agree, there's definitely movies that I think you like to use the Christmas time of year, the spirit of Christmas, people falling in love, all that sort of stuff. And like even the what was the Lindsay Lohan movie that's just come out on Netflix?
Falling for Christmas.
And again, even that, I mean, I guess the, you know, the trigger point or the plot device I have is the little girl making the Christmas wish and they're kind of being the Santa Claus and it's there and all that stuff around that. But I mean,
it is so weird that there's like an actual Santa going on in that movie.
Mm.
Like there's nothing like, I was about to say supernatural, but I guess
I was thinking
Santa kind of, you know, when you have movies, it's like.
But I love that he kind of does the tap the nose thing. I'm like, well, there's nothing
magical. And then at the end, like they get the sleigh, and it's like, yeah, he made the sleigh, but also this guy's clearly Santa. Like this is actual Santa.
Yeah.
And I did kind of feel like when they gave him the sleigh, it was like, well, if you can grant this kind of wish, like, couldn't you have just saved his goddamn hotel? The sleigh didn't save the hotel. It did nothing. Why didn't you just help this man?
Great Christmas movie.
Yeah, not the Christmas movie we're talking about on today's episode.
No.
Great Christmas movie.
It's not, but
Fingers crossed it'll have a sequel.
I think there's definitely... Well, like even, you know, a movie that is, you know, was a huge hit at the time. I remember it like yesterday when Dad brought it home on VHS. We even had Red Rooster for dinner that night and it was a big deal when we saw Gremlins.
Vivid memory.
Yeah, and we had... we watched Gremlins and again... For a long time, I never even thought about it so much as a Christmas movie. It's set at Christmas. Snow. And I just think there's so much happening because it's the Gremlins and the Mogwais and you're trying to get your head around it and so much of the violence. You go, oh, my God, it's set at Christmas. There's Christmas trees. There's the snowman. But again,
there's a whole plot point about, like, she hates Christmas because her dad got caught in the chimney trying to be... Christmas is a huge part of that movie. It's not inconsequential.
It is, but it's something that's not advertised within any of the promotional material, and it's just something that's just... Happens. Like, oh, wow. And then I think if you hadn't seen Gremlins for a while and was pretty vague on it and you just know the main points, you probably would forget that Christmas is involved until you watch it again. Oh, okay, that's Christmas. And then I guess the plot device there is that the Mogwai that starts off this whole thing is a Christmas gift for Billy. So I don't know. I think sometimes Christmas movies can be a little bit tedious. I mean, when I say tedious, I think they're calling them Christmas movies can be a bit tenuous, I would say, is the better word, not tedious.
Yep, I agree with that completely.
Unless you've watched 25 days of rom-coms, Christmas rom-coms, then it's a bit tedious.
Yeah, there's some grim ones out there. With all the streaming services vying for our eyeballs this time of year, there are some really grim Christmas movies that are going around, which have nothing to do with Christmas.
Before we smash into our movie or our Christmas movie that we are talking about, I did watch, and this would have been last Christmas, and speaking of your 25 days of Christmas, if you want to pick up a movie to watch, a movie that's actually critically panned that I watched that was stupid fun was, I think it's called A Christmas Party. I can't remember the actual title, but Jason Bateman's in it.
Oh, yeah, I know.
Jennifer Aniston's in it. Yeah. And I'm like, yeah, it's over the top stupid, but it's like, there's Christmas people and people want to get drunk and get stoned and... But they're very similar to the Lindsay Lohan movie. They've got to close a deal. They've got to get a deal to save everyone so no one gets laid off. So it's kind of this cliche thing. Is like, we don't want to lay off these people before Christmas. That's terrible.
Just like Work Christmas Party. It was like a very generic title.
Yeah. So
do you rate it? You think it's good?
Again, first, just, you know, a 90-minute just
office stupid. Office Christmas Party, not Work Office Christmas Party. Yes. Office. Still pretty generic.
Yeah.
I have a similar like. Thing I can't remember if it was last year or the year before I discover it, but Night Before or The Night Before, the Seth Rogen Christmas movie about a guy who's Jewish on the night before Christmas, and his wife is pregnant, and so she's like, this is like your last Christmas to go crazy with your friends, so she gives him and his two best friends a giant bag of drugs and he's like, go have a great night, and it's just like a caper movie over one night and Miley Cyrus in it and singing a Wrecking Ball, and Michael Shannon's in it playing a weed dealer who might actually be Santa Claus. And it's crazy. And people kind of, it came out and people were like, meh, and sort of forgot about it. It's great. It's a great Christmas movie. I don't know why everyone just like got over it and moved on. It should be watched every year. It's really, really fun.
Anyway, we probably should crack into Die Hard 2.
Still none of these are the movies we're talking about for Christmas this year.
It's the season.
Well, I think this is our Christmassy themed episode anyway, so we might as well, you know,
it is.
Talk about, you know, what's a really good Christmas movie that I just watched? The Holiday, that Emma Roberts movie.
Yes, Yes, I saw that.
Is this another Emma Roberts Christmas movie?
Yeah.
Well, technically, the other one's probably a New Year's movie, but I counted it as Christmas.
The Holiday is from last year, or even the year before, possibly. Yeah, it's been on Netflix.
Cable the Resident Emma Roberts aficionado. Yeah. Just straight in there. There's a streaming service, there's the release date, there's the plot.
Stalker.
There's the amount of minutes that Emma's on screen for the feature. It's 96 minutes, but there's only 90 minutes of Emma, so I'd give it a 4 out of 5.
Well, have you seen The Hunt?
I have seen The Hunt, and I laughed and I laughed and I
because
laughed.
You knew how I would be devastated, or
no? Well, just I thought it was quite hilarious how they played that. And that, have you seen The Hunt, Michelle?
No.
Oh, well,
if you ever get around to it, there's something quite amusing that they do with Emma Roberts' character that was not telegraphed or advertised at all. So when it happens in the movie, it is genuinely surprising. And when it happened, I was like, and that tickled me for like the next 20 minutes of the film. I wasn't really paying attention. Die Hard 2, you brought this up, and this is one of the first things I wanted to talk about, Cable, when we're talking about Die Harder. I swear to God, when I was a kid, this movie was called Die Hard 2, semicolon, Die Harder. I think that was just
why is
the
Michelle the person that has no idea?
Because I did the research like you told me to, and I looked it up, and it was never called Die Harder.
It's just the poster, isn't it? The poster just says Die Harder.
But I think, in fairness, like if we saw that poster at the video shop or at the cinema, we would think it was called semicolon Die Harder. Like it was big, bold letters like the title. So
when I was 6, when it came out and I saw the poster, and I was like, oh, that movie's called Die Hard 2, Die Harder.
Yeah, I mean, all the posters. I mean, if you go to IMDb, the first main, I guess, the poster they've got is Die Harder, and then it says Die Hard 2. So, and that would be the poster most of us would have.
Which I like. Until we started talking about doing this episode, I never thought about the fact that whether it's the name of the movie or just like the tagline they went with, that's so dumb. Die Harder. That's so stupid. Like, I never thought about my entire life that was anything less than brilliant. And then I started saying it, like, too many times. I was like, Die Harder? What? What?
And where do you go from there?
It's not even a language that you speak, Die Harder. Like, the third one might as well have been called Die Harderer.
Or Die Hardest.
Die Heaps.
Yeah. Just keep dying.
Well, I won't go too far down the rabbit hole, but it's funny that we also are talking about the title because the other sequels have had several different titles depending on what area of the world they come out in. So Die Hard 4 here is called Die Hard 4.0, but then in America it was called Live Free and Die Hard. And
but they didn't think that foreign markets would get that because that's such a Texan thing. Like that's their state
motto.
Well, like Live Free.
Yeah, it was a state motto or something. Yeah, along those lines. So people are like, oh, we don't get it. Like it's true. It's like why call again when it's sort of like a. It was almost like a reboot to a point or like a recall in that it'd been so long since there'd been a movie and it's kind of like, oh, I don't know. I don't know why they tried to rebadge it or something else.
I thought we weren't allowed to use the word recall on this podcast anymore. I thought Angus made a rule.
Oh, did he?
Nothing is allowed
overruled.
Nothing is allowed to be called a recall. We are allowed to reference the absurdity of that, but no one is allowed to call any movie, including the people making the movie. No one's allowed to call it a requel. Looking at you, Scream 5. Oh, no, this isn't Scream 5. Oh, what's the sequel called? Scream 6. Yeah, get in the bin.
So I guess one of the interesting things is what I think used to sort of happen in this era of films is normally when a sequel is churned out within that sort of 18 months or the 1 year to 18 months after the first movie goes gangbusters is they try and bring back everyone, regardless of whether the plot really requires it or just out of, you know, we need to bring the whole gang back. So, of course, Bruce Willis is back as John McClane.
Look at you, Highlander 2, The Quickening.
Bonnie Bedelia is Holly McClane. She's back again. So that makes perfect sense. But the fact that they somehow squeeze in William Atherton as Thornburg again and then Reginald L. Johnson as Al Powell, which I didn't hate because that was just a phone call.
Yeah, that's the easiest one to explain away. That makes the most sense. Like you have your friend's phone number, you need some help, you call your friend. Like that one I totally buy.
Yeah.
William Atherton is a stretch, but he was the comedic character. So I'm like, all right, what I genuinely feel bad for is Bonnie Bedelia being handed this script. It's like, hey, we're doing a sequel. We want you back. It's like, great. And then she reads, it's like, I spend the whole fucking movie in a plane. I spend the whole fucking movie just sitting in a plane seat next to an old woman. Next to an old woman with just taser. Talking about nothing. And then, okay, I get to punt, I get to taser that guy once. And then the rest of the movie, I just sit on the that's it? That's what you guys wrote for me as the returning lead?
I did love her line at the end, though. Like, why does this keep happening to us? Is that what she says?
Yeah. The wrong man in the wrong place, the wrong damn time.
I don't know what it is. Even as a kid, when I had first seen these movies, and not even at that age was I super analyzing films anyway, but I always did feel like it was almost like she wasn't the greatest of actresses. So it was like easy to go, okay, well, we'll have her in a few scenes. She has to look in peril, but it's like we don't need a performance from her. And that's why she doesn't have much to do. But I think that's just plot-wise. It's like they both times it's not important. We just got to follow that formula. And then she's never been in one of the movies since. And I know you always hear rumors when there was a Die Hard movie coming up about trying to get her back from a cameo or something. But they just sort of write it in that she's not there for whatever reason and things are on the rocks again and stuff.
Oh, so they're still married. She's just not in the next one.
I won't spoil. I mean,
if you haven't seen three, it genuinely is like it's a great, great film, and it's worth going into knowing little to nothing about it, and it's definitely something we have to talk about in the future because it is one of the great sequel/concluding chapter to a trilogy kind of story. Really, like they brought it home. Which I mean, the only thing I will tell you about it is when they wrote the script, it was not a fucking Die Hard movie. They wrote this script called Simon Says, and then someone was like, we need a Die Hard movie. And one of the producers was like, just cross out that title, call it Die Hard with a Vengeance. It's the same movie. The same movie, guys. And it is. Yep. It's genuinely brilliant. But that's not the one we're talking about today. We're talking about this. You talked about some of the cast already. Something I didn't realize until recently. So Esperanza, played by Franco Nero, who is a great actor who has been in everything. And you probably, if you're listening in Franco Nero, a lot of Westerns, a lot of spaghetti Westerns.
Yeah.
Worked sort of around forever. He was still going. He's in John Wick 2. He's in Django Unchained. He was Django. That's probably the thing he's known for. He was the Tarantino one, the original Django. But he was a big spaghetti Western guy, popped up in, countless of those movies. I think 225, I think, was the note that I had. He's done 225 films. Wow. So he was a good get for this, especially in the 90s. He was really going strong then. And William Sadler as the the villain with one of the great villain introductions ever.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the main naked bad taekwondo. Guy, the naked taekwondo. How did you find the naked taekwondo introduction, Michelle?
Interesting.
Oh, really? How does it rank against the Top Gun Maverick beach scene for you?
It doesn't.
What? What are you talking about? It's the same thing. You've got a ripped, sweaty, oily dude.
Well, if you cut out his head.
Yeah. I think Michelle needs to put the I Ain't Worried song over the top of that scene and she would change her mind.
If he was holding a football, you'd be on board.
I did love how he turns off the TV with his ninja move. It was very strange.
Yeah. And do you know why reason why that's his introduction into the movie?
No, but I did see that they filmed that at the end of the movie, so he had time to get in shape.
Yeah, because Rennie Harlan thought it would look cool. That was it. Rennie Harlan was like, you know what would look cool is if we introduced the villain and he was naked doing Tai Chi. But when he was interviewed about it years later, they were like, why was he naked doing Tai Chi? He's like, well, I thought it'd be cool, but I also wanted a new and interesting way to introduce a villain in the movie, and I hadn't seen it before, and I thought it'd be memorable. And here we are talking about it. And the interview was all right, yeah, good.
It was definitely the first thing in my notes. It just says, what did my notes say? Naked guy.
Is that just your notes, though, that you just have every day for life?
Yes.
I feel like that's just a note on your computer. It's just a sticky note that's pinned to your homepage. And every time you open your laptop, it just says naked guy. And yes.
It's like the top thing in bold. That was one of my only notes on this movie, naked guy.
That's great. I'm going to go watch a classic action movie featuring one of the great 80s, 90s action heroes. Mm-hmm. And my takeaway is going to be Naked Guy. Not even the name of the actor or character.
No. Just I don't even remember any of that. Just
Guy.
Naked Guy.
But I was going to say, though, I kind of, while it kind of is a bit of a weird scene, I kind of like it as the introduction in that, you know, Hans Gruber, you know, kind of could be a bit flabby around the waist or whatever, and he's in his suit, and that was his look. Whereas they're going, oh, this guy's ex-military. He's still ripped. He's super fit. He takes care of himself. And I guess it at least plants the idea that when there's a bit of hand-to-hand combat or something with him and John McClane, that you think it's going to go the distance at least, instead of some guy just falling out of a window. So, yeah. It's Rennie Harlan, the director. What, you know, this is a sequel. What was the sequel he did before this?
The one he did directly before this?
Yeah, don't look it up.
No, I'm pretty sure I remember it. Michelle probably
would have no idea.
We might have been talking about it in the group chat earlier.
We talk about so much in the group chat.
All right, I'm just going to give it to you. A Nightmare on Elm Street 4, The Dream Master.
Oh, I was talking about A Nightmare on Elm Street 2.
You were also talking about the fact that a friend of the show, William Lee Perry, may have appeared in Dream Master. So
this
you
is
had
true.
You had an easy in there.
Yeah,
he did The Exorcist, The Beginning, which was
the prequel.
Is it like the fourth movie or something? 2004.
Yeah, well, it's. I think Exorcist: The Beginning is that. I'll have to.
Sounds like a prequel.
Notes on this, and it is. But there is a weird thing that happened with the Exorcist prequels, where they made an Exorcist prequel, and the studio was like, "This is awful. We don't like it." And so they released it, but then they just went and made another Exorcist prequel straight away. And I think that might have been Dominion. Okay, if I had my notes in front, I could tell you this because I've researched the hell out of it because it absolutely fascinates me. It's one of the few cases. You know when you watch a movie and you're like, that sucked. Why? I want them to make that movie again but better. This is one of the times when they're like, oh, no, we're going to do that. We're going to make that movie again but better straight away. We're not going to wait 40 years. He also directed another incredible action movie that I think is starting to come back around after getting forgotten or mocked a little bit for years, Cliffhanger. He directed Stallone, Cliffhanger.
I love Cliffhanger.
I love it too, and I've never stopped loving it, but I feel like it really fell out of favor for a while. Maybe when Stallone became a bit of a caricature sort of in the early 2010s, people went off him, so they kind of wrote off a lot of his back catalog and were like, no, he's not good. Like post Copland, everyone's like, fuck Stallone. Even though Copland is great, I'll fight you, and he's great in it.
I feel like my memories of Cliffhanger at the cinemas, not that I saw it that time, but was big at the cinemas, but especially on VHS, was huge.
Oh, I rented the crap out of that movie. Mm. Like, that was almost like a weekly Friday night thing with my friends. We would sit down and watch Cliffhanger. Mm. And that opening scene, we would just like rewind and watch again because we'd like, how did they do this? This is insane.
Was there naked guys?
No, there's
no naked guys. There is a lovely young lady falling to her death while Stallone and Michael Rooker watch and scream. And that's the setting. It's also, I found it hilarious and still find it hilarious. It's got John Lithgow as the villain, who at the same time was appearing as the lead in Third Rock from the Sun, playing a ridiculous character. So you were like, Thursday nights on Channel 9, it's like, there he's being a wacky dude. And then Friday nights at the video store, you rent at Cliffhanger, and he's a psychopath. Rennie Harlan is had an interesting career because he was kind of like somebody who was really going places and like really getting bigger. And then he made Cutthroat Island. Uh-huh. Michelle, are you familiar with Cutthroat Island?
I am not.
It is a 1995 feature film starring Gina Davis and Matthew Modine.
Sorry, I read her book.
Yeah, so correct me if I'm wrong. Gina Davis and Rennie Harlan married at the time. Is that correct?
Yeah, pretty sure.
And she wanted to make it. And he was like, okay, I'll direct it. And it was kind of doomed from the start.
Yeah, it didn't do well.
It was the biggest box office bomb at the time.
Is it about pirates?
Yes.
Yeah, it's a pirate movie. It's a pirate movie in 1995 when no one wanted pirate movies. Like, you got to read the room
Johnny
a bit.
Depp.
Well, no one wanted pirate movies until Pirates of the Caribbean. And this movie is really responsible for that. There's been lots of articles written about how this movie killed the pirate movie. Because we all see it. Like, movies move in cycles. We're in a superhero phase at the moment, which I don't think surprises anyone. You know, we were in a pirate phase for a little bit with Pirates of the Caribbean, and we go through kind of monster or you know, big scary thing phases. We had kind of
vampires.
We had a bit of a run of King Kong and Godzilla. We had zombies for ages. We had vampires. It all kind of goes in cycles, and that Hollywood is bracing for, you know, pirates being the thing coming back, and a bunch of other studios had pirate movies in development. So like, yeah, it's about time for some swashbuckling. People are ready for that. Some good fun action. We got a few kind of things like The Phantom came around. That was a pirate movie, but it had like that adventure kind of swashbuckling aspect to it. Zorro with Antonio Banderas. We were kind of vibing it out. Cutthroat Island killed it. And the pirate movie was dead in the water. It was like, don't touch, don't go near it. No pirate movies. Kind of like how Batman and Robin torpedoed Batman movies for a long time. People are like, it's done, forget it, don't even talk about it. So Rennie Harlan was like, he was on the up. He had a really good thing going. He did his time in horror, you know, horror jail, like most young directors, where it's like, you got to go make the ninth, you know, Saw movie before we'll give you a real thing. He made the fourth.
But it's kind of crazy, no disrespect, but they obviously had a lot of faith in him, because I'm surprised he got handed this movie really early on in his career.
Yeah, well, he really had done nothing else, and he wasn't supposed to do this movie. It was only because McTiernan. It was only because McTiernan couldn't do it. He was all geared up to do it, and then he was working on something else, and schedules didn't align, and the studio was like, this movie has to come out, you know,
for Christmas.
Yeah, it has come out within this time frame, so it has to start shooting at this time. And I think it was kind of like, well, we've got Bruce, we've got Bonnie Bedelia, we've got William Atherton, we've got
Reginald Bell Johnson
in a cameo role. We've got the source material, because that's the thing that never really gets discussed about Die Hard and Die Hard 2, is they're both based on books. Mm-hmm. And Die Hard, funnily enough, is a sequel to a Frank Sinatra movie called The Detective. And Frank Sinatra was the first person cast to play John McClane in Die Hard, because the contract he signed with The Detective had a first right to refusal clause. So when they decided to make this movie, they had to give him the part, and then he could decide if he wanted to do it or not. So to get the movie like approved, the only way they get approved is like, and Frank Sinatra is playing John McClane. And then they went to Frank Sinatra, and he was like, I'm too old to hold up the gun. I don't think I can hold up the gun anymore. Like, I think it's too heavy. Like, that was the only thing I think that he really was worried about, not crawling through the vents or, you know, looking like he was anything other than an old man fighting some Germans. He was like, I don't think I can hold the gun anymore. And they're like, so you want to pass? He's like, yeah, I'll pass. So
that would have been a completely different movie.
Yeah, yes, it would. So yeah, the first one based on a book, this one based on a book called 58 Minutes. And I think that kind of felt pretty confident. Like, you got Bruce on the poster, you've got the title, and that's going to put asses in seats. You don't need a fancy pants director. I think they just wanted a gun for hire. He was probably cheap at that stage, and he'd proven he could, you know, wield a camera a little bit. So off he went. And this movie was really like his debutante. He was like, hey, here I am, this is what I can do. And they're like, yeah, man, here's money, go make more movies. Go make money movies for 5 years until you absolutely carpet bomb your career by making a movie with your wife. But in that 5 year period, we love you, Rennie Harlan. Do whatever you want.
Well, but even some of the other casts that are in there, like, it's just such a good cast. Like, John Amos is this, like, again, I knew him from being the kind of, not quite sleazy, but the, you know, the dad who owns McDowell's in Coming to America.
Yes,
and it's like almost all of a sudden he's like stone cold killer. And then you have Dennis Franz, which, again, I think by the time I'd seen this, he was already in NYPD Blue, or one of the big shows he was in as a copper as well. So he's kind of doing a similar thing here. And again, he's annoying. And then he's obviously his brother-in-law, or his brother was the one that books John McClane at the start. And you go, oh, these guys are just complete pricks.
Great opening. I love the opening to this movie with him getting the ticket and being like in a fight with another cop, and the cop just doesn't care. That actor too, I couldn't tell you specifically what I know him from, but I just know him. Like, I look at his face and I'm like, oh, that guy. He's one of those that guy actors.
And then you've got you know, Fred Thompson's really good as, I guess, the chief in the
control room.
I don't know. There's something about this movie I just like, even just the people that just have small parts.
Cole Meaney plays a pirate. Goddamn pirates. Plays a pilot for one of the planes. He's got like three lines.
Pirate would be cool.
And he's out. Vondi Curtis Hall, who, you know, great, great dramatic actor, pops up as one of the grunts in this, and he's around for a little bit. My favorite one.
Robert Patrick?
He's the only one I recognized in this movie.
He's my second favorite. And he has that great line where they come up the escalator, which I love it, but also every time I rewatch it, it gets more and more insane. Yeah, because they're like, what do I look like to you? And he turns around, he's like, a sitting duck. Now, you've got a group of SWAT people protecting this guy because you're afraid that they're going to be attacked by these military who have overtaken the airport. And as you're walking up, this guy like deliberately tries to stop you walking up and then ignores you. And that doesn't make you think that perhaps this guy might be a threat. Like none of the SWAT guys have their guns raised. None of them are in position. Like he literally is just like walking. He's like, hey, what are you? And so when he turns around, there's sitting duck. He's like, yeah, you fucking idiot. Of course you got shot in the head. So he's my second favorite. My favorite is John Leguizamo.
Yes.
I don't know if you saw he's in this movie, Michelle. I don't even know if you know who he is. Do you know who John Leguizamo is?
I've heard the name, but that's about...
You know, John
He's Luigi.
He was a Luigi in the Super Mario Brothers movie. No, he was Tybalt in Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet.
Mm-hmm. He's in Moulin Rouge as well.
He plays Toulouse-Lautrec, but he is like... He's walking around his knees with shoes on his knees to make himself look shorter in that one. So,
oh, sure.
He's also in Spawn, but you wouldn't recognize him because he plays like a dwarf fat clown. He's a great, great actor. And you definitely, once you look him up after this, you'll be like, oh, fucking that guy.
Yeah, okay.
He's amazing. He was cast in this and meant to have a really quite significant role as one of the grunts and then got to set. And Rennie Harlan saw how short he was and was like, oh, no. And then cut him down to just one line. And then he found out when he went to watch the movie, they dubbed his line. And he doesn't even get an on-screen death. I don't know when, he might die on the plane. He might get shot earlier. I don't know when, but he's in the movie a bit, and then he's not. Like at least Robert Patrick gets killed by John McClane in a shootout. Like he gets a proper death. But yeah, poor old Leguizamo is gone. Mark Boone Jr. is in this movie, and I couldn't spot him. He's another one, Michelle, who you may not know his name, but you would know his face. Mm-hmm. He was in famously in Sons of Anarchy. That was like his most recent big role. He played like one of the main guys in the biker gang, but he's another actor who's just been around forever. He's a great character actor. Really love him. Yeah, like you look through who is in this movie and you're like, there is a lot of people who went on to keep doing good work.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Just like consistently good work as well. And I don't think you would really suspect that from the roles they are given in this movie. Like, here's like one speaking line and then get the fuck out of this movie. And it's like, all right, in 30 years, people will remember you and you'll be working and you'll probably be making better movies than old Bruce in a lot of ways. Yeah. Sadly, didn't quite go his way. But yeah, incredible cast. Crazy that it came together at all. I guess like these days, you know, when films get rushed into production to churn out a sequel, things don't tend to go well. But with this one, I feel like, I don't know, it must have had the full support of the studio, everyone working together. Like the scene where McClane is coming up through the grate as the airplane is coming towards him and he gets stuck and he's trying to like get out and roll out of the way just in time. That one shot was filmed at 6 different locations to get it right. So like him coming up to the grate is one location. Him popping out of the grate is another location. The plane coming towards him is another location. The plane actually going over the grate is another location. Like all of those shots were pieced together from shoot because the location they found they couldn't quite get right. So they just were like, all right, like that alone tells you the studio was like, do what you need to do to make this movie great. And we have our full support. And I just don't think we get that with particularly sequels anymore. Certainly not sequels to action movies. You know, I think action movies get reduced budget and shorter timelines and are expected to be bigger and better in a lot of ways, unless you're James Cameron. But everyone else, you know, even the John Wick movies, they're sort of the most successful action movies at the moment. But that is a law of diminishing returns in terms of how much money they'll put in. You know, you see that the star power is slowly decreasing each movie because they obviously don't want to pay people. So they're not putting anyone in. The people they do put in are cameo roles. A different time, and I miss it. I miss action movies being like this. It was great. Do it again. What are you doing, Hollywood? You bastards.
Make an Avatar.
No. Oh. So this was your listeners will probably figure this out if they've listened to the episode before, but this was your first time watching Die Hard 2, Die Harder, wasn't it, Michelle?
It was, straight after I watched Die Hard for the first time.
Wow. On the same day, no
yeah,
less.
Back to back.
So you back to back it. When doing that for the first time in 2022, with the current way that cinema is going back to late 80s, early 90s, were you on board with like the antics, with the impossibility of the man being the wrong man in the wrong place at the wrong damn time? Or were you like in it and be like, let's go, let's do it?
Well, I enjoyed the first one, and then we got to the second one and I was like, oh, really?
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. So give me that. Like what happened between one and two? What is it about two that didn't tickle the right part of your brain?
I just feel like the first one just had more of like an interesting story. And then the second one, I was like, really? It's just Bruce Willis blowing shit up and shooting people for another 2 hours. Like, do we need to do this again? But this time there's planes. Like, it was kind of the same movie, just set in a different location and without Alan Rickman.
Yeah, who's your favorite villain? Do you like Alan Rickman? Do you like William Sadler?
Oh, I liked Alan Rickman. I thought he
It's hard
well.
To beat, isn't it? I mean, what do you think, mm-hmm. Cable? Who like? Do you have a favorite? Out of Rickman
I think
or Sadler?
You can't really go past the original, but I think there's something about the thing I was thinking about this movie. The killers are more hardcore in this one. I think are more cutthroat, and I think there's almost those double crosses within each, like the way John Amos just turns around and. Did he slash the guy's throat?
Yeah, he cuts his throat.
Mm-hmm. He cuts his throat, and it was
there's
like...
There's that one guy who's on the team who's not meant to be there because the original guy got appendicitis and got replaced last minute. And so when they're going to kind of help out the bad guys and you know, the reveal happens, there's that scene that still, it upset me the first time I saw it, and it still upsets me now when he's like, oh, you know, really wish I could have been there with you, sir. And he's like, me too. And you see, like, the look in the kid's eyes. He's like, it's the greatest day of his life. Mm-hmm. He's like, really, sir? Like, oh, my God, I've made it. This great war hero has approved me. I'm in. This is the greatest day of my life. He's like, I wouldn't have to do this. And then just cuts his fucking throat. And everyone just stares at him and watches him bleed to death. I'm like, that is harrowing. Mm. I think that's more upsetting than anything Rennie Harlan did in Nightmare on Elm Street 4, honestly. Mm. Nothing affected me in that movie.
Yeah, so I feel like there's almost a competing bad guys. Like there's the main objective, but then there's these other people that are strung along that have probably been promised something else, which William Sadler's not going to necessarily come through with. And even just like the cold-blooded killing of the guy that lives in the church, like...
Oh, that is...
Like he doesn't have to die too. He's like, mate, we just need to use this for the night. Just go home. He's $100. He's going. It's like, no, we'll
just
blow him away.
Him in the head with the butt of the pistol and tie him up. Like, you do not have to shoot the guy.
Mm. Especially in a church. But it's like, I just feel like this one kind of takes it up a notch. Not that in the first movie they didn't kill people, but that they weren't intending to really kill anyone necessarily.
Well, they would have been quite happy to walk away without killing anyone. Like they just wanted to get the gold and get the bonds. Is it bonds or gold? It's bonds. They're bearer bonds and get out of there. And then they just want to like cover their exit, but they're not necessarily out to murder people.
And I mean, in that first one too, I think the only one they really sort of walk in and just like, you know, it's going to be a killer is with the security guard on the front door is the first bang. Yeah. Just put one in him and then put a guy in his seat and that's about it. That's the one casualty. And you could argue that if things were going to plan, they don't need to kill anyone else apart from the boss when he doesn't give them the codes. You know, and that could have been, that was a clean sweep, you know, for them. Whereas this one, I feel like they don't care how many bodies. It's just like, we got to get this done. And this is how full on we are.
I mean, he crashes an entire plane. Mm-hmm. Just to prove a point.
Well, yes.
Like this, this movie has the highest body count of any Die Hard movie and one of the highest body counts of any action movie because of that plane crash. 114 people get killed in just like, there you go. I did that just to prove to you I would. So yeah, I think William Sadler, I keep like his character name is Stuart. Colonel Stuart. He is totally. Totally insane. The one thing I really struggle to buy in this movie, in this world that they set up, is when he's in the airport and everyone kind of recognizes him and like the reporter is like, oh my God, that's Colonel Stuart, and like runs over And McLean, when he sees him, he's like, "You look kind of familiar." He's like, "I'm on TV. I get that a lot." And then later he's like, "Oh my God, that's Colonel Stewart." Like, this guy is just a colonel in the army. He's not a celebrity. Who the hell are these people that they are so like, well, like name me one like military, one Australian military person.
The one that's in trouble at the moment?
That you would, even the one that's in trouble.
No,
if you walk past them in the airport on Christmas Eve,
would you recognize them?
Like, oh my God, that's that guy.
No,
and, and even if you did recognize him, you'd be like, oh my God, that's Colonel Stewart. Or would you be like, that's that fucking guy from the new, the guy who did the thing. Like,
yeah.
Would any of you be like, that's Colonel Stewart. He served with such and such in this campaign of blah, blah, blah. And he get 37 confirmed kills. And he's like, who the hell is remembering all these fucking war guys? And also, isn't he meant to be Black Ops? Isn't that his whole thing? Is that he runs all these Black Ops things and everyone knows him? He's like James Bond. He's like the worst spy ever.
He's not doing everyone's a very good
job. Oh, there's the secret ops guy. Everyone knows his name, his face.
I mean, that's probably where it starts to, not be believable. But I could see in that world when you've only got a couple of channels, if he was really big, like a war hero and stuff like that, and he's of his high rank and he's maybe someone that has to get up in front of the media and talk a lot, I could totally see him being recognized, or at least maybe not necessarily the name, but like to the the part where McLean kind of recognized him, like, oh, I know that face. Like, I could get and then the reveal being that the reporter says Colonel Stewart, and he's, oh, that's who it is. I believe that could happen, because I feel like there's some, I can't remember anyone's name off the top of my head, but there's definitely military people, whether it's Australian military or even American military, who are big or have been in that role for a long time, that you kind of half recognize a little bit. If you follow, especially pop culture stuff, like, I feel like it's believable to a point, but I agree with you. If he's supposed to be a lot Black Ops, he should be so under the radar that no one should really know his face. So I agree with you in that point.
I found that bit to be absolutely hilarious. And also that McLean, he's John McLean, obviously, like, with the suspension disbelief, he's the one man who stands alone against the world and saves the day kind of thing. But there's a couple of moments where you're like, what the hell is everyone doing? I think the most prevalent is when he's having that argument with Dennis Franz about everyone's being tricked and doesn't believe him. So he pulls out an Uzi and just unleashes in a room full of cops, not a single one of whom draws their gun and shoots him for firing. Like, at what point do these police think, maybe I should do something? This guy just pulled out an Uzi and pointed at the chief of police and then started firing.
It was like, blanks.
Are they all waiting to see blood before they're like, now we can shoot him? Like, that was, that was laughable. But also the fact that, like, he keeps coming back into the control tower. And the cops keep taking him out, and he keeps coming back in. And like, at one point, Dennis Franz is like, if you're not careful, you're going to spend the night in lockup. It's like, it's been an hour and a half in this movie, and he has tried to shoot you, threatened you, called you a fat, dumb fuckhead, like everything he could. And only at the very, very last moment, you're like, oh, I might put you in jail maybe if you keep doing this.
Maybe.
Like, I get that he's meant to be the hero and Dennis Franz is meant to be the dumb, fat idiot cop who doesn't understand what's going on, but come on, man. He tried to shoot you with an, even if they are blanks, like, if you're not shot, you should at least be spear tackled, cuffed, punched in the back of the head.
Yeah.
Like, not one person is like, you can't do that. Everyone's like, oh, there were real bullets. Oh, okay, that's fine.
On your way.
It's one of those things where, unfortunately, they're in an area where clearly the cops there are not any good.
Well, this is the same thing we talked about with our Halloween episodes.
Exactly.
The police force is
coming on with movie cops.
Police force and hospitals.
John McClane is the one movie cop who goes good. And I also love that McClane gets angry at the cop who arrests him for having a gun and no badge. He's like, I'm a cop. He's like, where's your badge? He's like, on its way to Cincinnati or something. And then the cop arrests him. And then he's angry at the cop. The cop's like, sorry, sir, had to be sure. It's like, yes, you should be sure.
Yeah.
You should take his word for it. Come on. Like, the one decent cop is like, oh, I'm sorry, I did my job. Ridiculous. Oh, my God. It is a similar movie. And I'm talking about this. But I don't know how you guys feel at this. I feel the fact that, A, like, John McClane can leave whenever he wants. In fact, he's repeatedly told, get the fuck out. I know he's like, his wife is on one of those planes, so he feels emotionally invested. And it is not just like he can leave whenever he wants, but he's constantly going different places. Yeah, he's crawling through a couple of events every now and again, but really he's like, he goes outside, there's a snowmobile chase, which is cool, but
yeah,
he's driving around. That opening that world up when the first one was so claustrophobic, I think it really, like, it kills a lot of what makes this so good, what made the first one so good. Do you guys find that, like, opening it up like that really kind of loses a lot of tension, especially when you back-to-back it like you did, Michelle?
I think a little bit, and I think it makes it less believable to an extent, if Die Hard can be a believable movie that he's just,
I mean,
like,
I think I buy Die Hard. I think I buy it. Like, it takes a little bit of, you know, a stretch down the old suspension disbelief, but not much. I can buy that happening in real life.
Oh, I think that can happen, but like him surviving and doing all the crap that he does, when we were talking to Bill, the stuntman, he said he saw something that said like John McClane should have died like multiple times in these movies from his injuries.
Yeah, there's actually,
I'll always forgive
yeah,
that stuff.
There's actually a funny, I don't know if it's still up, but I remember seeing it years ago, a YouTube video where someone had kind of shown all the collisions and all the injuries that John McClane suffered in just the first Die Hard movie. Mm-hmm. You know, what should he, you know, like what sort of injuries should he have? And then kind of made it like a video game, like, oh, he died here. And then he's, you know, respawning. And then how many lives he would have lost in each movie kind of thing. So, and it's really funny. It's funny that you say believable, because I remember the first time I saw Die Hard and it was like, I loved it so much. And it was like probably the best action movie I'd seen at that point. And I actually thought, oh, I loved it because it felt so believable. And it's only just now like, oh, well, the amount of, you know, punching and falling downstairs and running across glass and all that, you go, oh, well, at some point you can't, your body can't take that much of a beating without something happening. But for a long time, I probably go, oh, that was really believable. And then you get to this movie and then obviously they try and up the ante and it's definitely a little bit more over the top. I hadn't also, going back to what you're saying about the snowmobiles or the, what do you even call them? I guess.
I think they're like snowmobiles or I think they snow dudes, some of them call, because they're like.
I actually really like that scene, but I kind of can sort of see, I hadn't really thought about it, but I can see what you're saying, that it's kind of, if you're trying to replicate Die Hard, like you said, it's this claustrophobic, they're in a building, they can't really get help out necessarily, so he's on his own, whereas this one, it does feel like he can roam a fair bit, and it's kind of, like you said, like he seems to get into the, you know, the office, control deck quite easily. You know, he's in the tunnels with Marvin. You know, he's out on the
tarmac repeatedly.
Sorry, he's out on the tarmac, yeah. And then he's, next minute, he's chasing other people and then he's getting blown out of the plane by, you know, the ejector seat and all that sort of stuff. So
now let's just pause right there for a second, because that particular moment in the film, when he's in there and they're throwing all the grenades in and he's panicking, looking what to do, and he gets in and he pulls the ejector seat and the plane blows up, that might be one of the coolest things in any action movie ever. That is brilliant. I don't care if it's ridiculous and unbelievable and that somehow the first grenade that gets thrown in takes like a minute longer to explode than every other grenade. I don't give a shit. Like, finding a way to make that, to not only get it into the movie, but make it pretty seamless. Like, of all of the crazy stuff that goes on in this movie, him ejecting himself out of a plane that's being blown up, that makes total sense. Like, the whole thing is about planes. He's trying to capture the general. He doesn't quite do it. He's trapped in the plane. They're trying to kill him. They throw in the, like, that just beat for beat. That's one of the best written, absurd action scenes I can think of. Like, whenever there's a crazy action scene, you're like, you guys had to work so hard to get there. Good God, that was ridiculous. This one, I'm like, you don't even realize it's happening. Like, as it's going on, you don't realize you're getting set up for an absurd action moment. You just got to watch me like, oh, wow, it's all grenades. Oh, shit. How's he going to get out of this one? Yeah. And you know he's going to get out of it because he's John McClane. Mm-hmm. But the way he gets out of it, every time I watch it, I'm like, it's almost like a magic trick. It's so well done. It's so well done.
But it works on another level on that it's good because the villains don't know he got away, at least initially. They think, oh,
I think they can't get away. When they do catch the canopy, they're like,
yeah, they do, but a bitch. But it's kind of like initially they're like, they think, oh, beautiful, he's done. Yeah, and then all of a sudden it's like,
we got him, suck it. Yeah, which is brilliant. And I'm racking my brain. I'm only really thinking about the first three Die Hard movies because I haven't seen the other ones that much, and there is a sharp drop off in my opinion of quality. But apart from like the fire hose around the waist in Die Hard 1.
Mm-hmm.
I can't really think of another like amazing moment that they managed to get into a Die Hard film that really makes you go like, holy shit, that's so good. You know, and not taking anything away from Die Hard with a Vengeance, that I think that whole movie is great, but I can't think of like a moment that they get into it that works that way. Maybe I'm forgetting something blatantly obvious and people
comment. I'm just trying to think. There's a couple of, there's a really ridiculous one, but fun one. In number four, I'm just trying to think. I'm sure there's something
the
in Die
helicopter
Hard
in four.
Is it cool? Well, the plane, and then he's sliding down the broken road, kind of on the
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's pretty cool.
Oh, did I have him with a Venice? Was he on top of the truck at one point? Okay.
Oh, there's so many trucks in that movie. He's probably on top of the truck a lot. But yeah, I just think I genuinely like. Even if this movie doesn't quite stack up against the first one. And I think, I don't think it does. I think it's good. I think it's enjoyable. I think it does a great job of replicating what made Die Hard enjoyable in that it, you know, it lets Bruce Willis be John McClane, which at this period of his acting, he was crushing. Like he was crushing being John McClane. Especially after the first one being his proper big break and, you know, no one thinking it was going to work. Like they didn't even put his face on the posters of the first one because they're like, that's the guy from the sitcom. We're not putting him on an action movie poster. No one will go see
is
it.
So moonlighting?
It was just the exploding thing. And this is something I only found out recently. Like he was 30 years old and a bartender going nowhere because he just couldn't like get an audition. And when he got an odd one here and there, he failed miserably. And then he got moonlighting, and then he was kind of an instant success, and he got really well known. But he was like, he was just about done. He was like ready to walk away from even trying because he was failing so hard. And then he got that one TV show, and then he got that one movie, which was Die Hard, which I like, don't put his face on the poster. This is going to be a horrible mistake. And then it was a brilliant success. Like, this is the movie where they finally, like, you do you. Like, to the point where, you know, in the first movie, there was no real joke stuff. That was all ad-libbed by Bruce Willis. And McTiernan was like, actually, that's pretty good. We'll keep that. That's pretty funny. Yeah, I like that. And then with Die Hard 2, there was like in the script, it said, like, Bruce, say something funny here. Like, they're like, you go crazy. You ad-lib as much as you want. You do you, man. So he really, like, let his flag fly in this one. But it doesn't quite do it, which is hard. But that one scene, that one scene in the,
makes
in the cockpit, 1,000 times over. It's so good. It's so, so, so good. I would watch the movie again tonight just to watch that.
Yeah,
movie.
I'm love it.
You probably
would. You've just talked me into it as well.
it's great. Was there aspects of it that you, like, did you get on board with Bruce Willis's shtick, Michelle? Because again, I'm curious, like, I grew up with John McClane and like, I'm like, I'm all in on John McClane, even later day John McClane.
Well, even by extension, like the John McClane thing kind of feels like it's a little bit in Look Who's Talking as well, because he does the voiceover of the kid. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that is that sort of, you know, smart assy kind of one-liners. And
well, that became
it's his voice, and it's kind of like, it feels like, well, he's just a different version of John McClane. It's just, he's a kid now. And,
yeah, or Hudson Hawk is a different version of John McClane. It's just, he wears a hat now. Or the whole nine yards, a different version of John McClane. It's just he's a hitman now. Like his memorable movies are always him going back to the well, being like, this is going to be, I'm either going to make literally another Die Hard or I'm going to do another movie where I'm basically John McClane.
Yes.
Does it work in 2022 for you coming across it for the first time, Michelle?
I think so. Like he was enjoyable to watch. And like that yippee-ki-yay thing is like, you know that before you've even seen Die Hard.
It's iconic. It's in the lexicon as one of the great film lines. Is it? Do you recognize, having seen Die Hard particularly, but even Die Hard 2 now, do you recognize like the impact that it's had in other movies and go, oh, right, I get it. Like that character is basically ripping off Die Hard, or that premise is ripping off Die Hard.
Not that instantly comes to mind, but I'm sure you can give me a list of things that I've probably missed in other movies.
Oh, not even like specifics that you missed, but just the impact that it has. Kind of like, you know, how the impact of Psycho with the shower scene, and, you know, showing everything and showing nothing, and the impact, even like Avatar, we're just talking about, you know, the 3D and the way that trickled down. Die Hard really was one of those movies that trickled, and because it had a sequel come out 18 months afterwards, that kind of like, no waiting 13 years for these guys.
I think one of the things that I thought was obviously very noticeable, and it gets talked about a lot, and maybe this is something Michelle wouldn't have necessarily picked up on if she hasn't seen all these other movies and grown up with them. But it was one of the first movies where they had a person that was kind of like an everyday guy. Like, he's a copper, but he's just the standard guy doing his job or wanting to do his job. He wasn't, before that, all action people, it was Stallone or it was Schwarzenegger. Guys had to be ripped, you know,
yeah.
Van Damme, Chuck Norris, like, it kind of, guys had to be ridiculously ripped.
And they were also always like,
yeah,
their job was like being a badass. Like, they were a military dude, or they were a cop, but they were like the toughest, baddest cop ever.
Yeah.
Or they were like a kung fu fighter, or they were a hitman or a body. Like, it was always a job that was like, there's a reason this guy is so good at kicking people in the throat, and it's because it's his job.
He was still pretty ripped, though. He wasn't like your, you know, that regular Joe, you know.
No, he wasn't quite dad bod, but he definitely was there.
He didn't have them pythons going on.
Yeah, it definitely was a massive change from, you know, the movies that had just come before it. Again, like I said, you have, you know, Rambo, and he's got the top off, and he's just got the headband, and there's almost like the massage oil on the skin, or the baby oil to make, you know, glisten in the sun. Like, there was none of that shit with John McClane. It was just like, yeah, okay, he's running around in a singlet, but overall, it's not about the body. It's not about the physique. It's about the one-liners and
yeah,
doing the time to light up a cigarette, you know, in the middle of drama. And
it's,
and things going on.
It's kind of the beginning of, we, instead of casting like jacked, crazy, strong dudes and getting to say a couple of funny things in an action movie, we will cast a funny guy and get him just to like lift some weights for an action movie, which has become more. I mean, I think Ryan Reynolds probably owes his career to Bruce Willis. Like, you know, be funny first and then get the six pack. Or Chris Pratt, you know, owes his career to Bruce Willis. He's basically modeled his career on Bruce Willis. Like, do the sitcom, be the funny guy, get some abs, become the action hero, and still be funny in the action roles. So, like, John McClane and Bruce Willis as John McClane really set the tone for where action movies would go. Because if you look, like, in the 80s, you know, it is those super crazy muscle dudes. And then the 90s, it starts to shift a little, and we get less and less of that. Like, apart from the superstars, you know, your Sly and your Schwarzenegger, the guys who weren't going anywhere because there was still money in box office. But it wasn't spreading out. Like, it became more and more about, let's get the everyman in there. Let's get a guy who, you know, looks like he's your regular bloke from down the pub. And, oh, my God, suddenly he's saving the day.
And then you see, like, a couple of years later, then you get, oh, Keanu Reeves, oh yeah, he'd be good, Point Break, yeah, well, who would have thought, oh, getting back Speed, oh, you know. And again, I would say, probably argue that Keanu back then would have been more ripped than Bruce Willis, but again, it wasn't about seeing his body and all that. He was just a fit guy that could sort of fight, and he was either a copper or, you know, something like that. But I mean, he wasn't, you know, overly ripped, or, you know, yeah, like you said, have the big pythons out, you know, show us your
probably
guns.
Michelle has seen none of these movies.
Yeah, maybe.
Is he jacked? Is he naked? Pass. Oh, skinny sad
Maverick?
Boy? No, thank you.
Yeah.
I don't want to see skinny sad boys with their shirts on. I want to see sexy naked men. So yeah,
I love a skinny sad boy.
You got your bowl full right at the start of this movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I do enjoy the use of 90s technology in this movie, like when he almost gets killed because his pager's going off.
So that is
the taser on the plane, and when she uses the plane phone, and she's like, "Yeah, technology. It's the 90s. Like, we don't
the
even
fact
do
that
now."
She's allowed to take a taser on a plane, like that. Just, but also the technology
goes...
of shutting down the airport. Like, that took that's the biggest suspension of disbelief. Is like, you can't communicate with any of the planes. It's like, anyone with a radio could communicate with those planes. It's just about frequencies. Like, it's not any special technology. It's still just radio technology. If you just drove down the road to a shop And like, do you have a walkie-talkie or do you have like a long-range transmitter? Yeah. Can I just grab this long-range transmitter? I've got to just get on the frequency and get this plan and be like, hey, this is, here's the code to let you know I'm actually the guy. The tower's been hijacked to land here. It's like, oh, okay. Because there's no, that's the other thing about this one, that it's an interesting idea. It's a very interesting idea, but it is something that easily falls apart, is that there is no, there's no bomb on the bus in this one. Like, there's nothing that is going to destroy the planes other than this guy pretending to be the tower and resetting the hard deck so that they crash without realizing. But at any point, you know, when that plane is like, hey, we're landing, all right, we just have to land, and then they land, well, there's nothing that the bad guys can do about it. It's like, well, we don't have any bombs. We're just going to let the plane, if they can land, they just land. So, oh, well, I guess you beat us at our own game. Adios.
The other weird thing about the planes, like the end when he releases like the petrol cap, is there nothing in that plane going, hey, all the petrol's like draining out of this plane right now, like we're going to explode?
I mean, before he does that, is that before or after he kicks John Amos through one of the engines?
I think it's after.
Bigger problems at that point. Really. Yeah. It's like one of the guys just got kicked through the engine. So what do we do is like, we get the fuck out of here as quickly as we can. We lost one of our engines and also one of our guys. This is the worst of both worlds. Something like probably less fun, but I am curious about like coming into these movies now, particularly you, Michelle, like the only female characters in this movie are a wife who sits in a chair, an old lady who sits in a chair, some stewardesses who are there to put up with an asshole, and a reporter who gets told to fuck off multiple times by multiple men.
Like, it was a different generation.
It was, but like watching these movies now for the first time, are you just sitting there as a female who's watching these movies being like, fuck all of you? Or are you able to like, are you able to tell your brain like, this is the like 80s, 90s. This is how they fucking did things. Or are you just like raging at it?
It didn't bother me, but it would have been cool if that lady with the taser, the old lady, if she'd saved the day.
That would have been better.
Yeah.
It would have been way better if it was the old lady and not Bonnie. I mean, Bonnie Bedelia is already doing nothing. It's don't throw that bone. It changes nothing. Just leave her. Leave her in her seat.
And I was confused. Why did she have a restraining order against that guy?
He had a restraining order against her.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Because
she punched him for... which also, funny sidebar, the only reason his character and that storyline is in Die Hard is because Bruce Willis was filming Moonlighting and wasn't available on a lot of days they were shooting.
Oh.
And they're like, well, we have to get the movie to a certain runtime and we don't have enough of Bruce to get the movie to the runtime.
We need a backstory.
So they wrote this story of like, oh, why don't we have this reporter who's like running around trying to find his family. And that can kind of be a little bit of a comedic element. And it also gets us out of Nakatomi Plaza every now and again, just to like give us some breathing room. Yeah, that's a good idea. But it was only because they didn't have Bruce Willis enough on the schedule. Because you notice like whenever there is a scene that's not Nakatomi Plaza, he's fucking in it.
And he's a jerk like his character in Ghostbusters. I mean, it's like, they're like, do that Ghostbusters thing. Just be the jerk.
Yeah, it is true. This man has no dick.
I like when he's like, I don't want to die.
There's great. He's a jerk in Biodome as well. I think he's just got a great jerk face.
Mm-hmm.
I bet he's a lovely guy too. I bet his whole life has just been like people being dicks to him. Because like, I fucking saw you in Die Hard. You tried to get John McClane's kids hurt. Like, madam, that was a role I was meant by. Say someone spat on him and walked away.
That's not scary. He's probably got that before, yeah.
Only movie in the Die Hard series where he is an LAPD cop.
Yes.
He's the only one. The rest of the time, he's not.
Spoiler alert.
Spoiler, yeah. But this is the one movie where he's LAPD. Every other Die Hard movie is NYPD. But he transfers for love. But yeah, that's just a fun little tidbit. The rest of the time, NYPD, gritty, the mean streets, concrete jungle. It was Hunt for the Red October was the film that McTiernan was doing. That it meant he couldn't come back to this. So not a bad trade-off, if I'm being honest. Like, that's a pretty sweet film that I think...
Yes.
I mean, I haven't watched it probably... I think it's been 5 years, if I think about it properly, since I've watched it.
But
5 years wasn't
time.
That long ago, and it's pretty good, apart from Sean McConnery playing a Russian guy, but just using the Sean Connery accent. But he played a Spanish guy with a Sean Connery accent. We forgave everything for Sean Connery in the 90s. Like, it is one of those movies, like, there are a couple of moments where it's like, what could have been? But you know, like, what if McTiernan came back? What if Bonnie Bedelia was like, fuck this, I'm not sitting on the plane.
Mm-hmm.
What if, you know, they couldn't get the rights to 58 minutes to keep this thing going? A lot of what ifs, but it all kind of came together and it kind of worked. I think the only other note that I have here that I meant to say earlier, but I'm going to say it anyway, with famous faces and people popping up, Liev Schreiber is an extra in this movie. You can see him for a brief moment. So kind of everyone who's in this movie walked away winning. Really, kind of like, I'm going to go have a fucking career now. I don't know. It's a wild ride. What else is there to say? What else do you guys have to say about Die Hard 2, Die Harder?
I'd love to know, like, obviously Michelle can't answer this question because she only just saw it. But, I mean, like, honestly, how many times have you maybe watched this and do you, you know, chuck it on often? If you've watched Die Hard, will you put this on or do that little bit of a marathon, or you just go straight to Die Hard with a Vengeance? Because I will admit that I have actually watched this quite a lot and can, you know, probably not so much in the last couple of years, but previous to that would have at least watched it once a year, maybe even twice a year. And then normally if I have time at Christmas, it's like Die Hard 1 or Die Hard, this one, and, you know, Home Alone or something like that leading into Christmas. Whereas when Tatflix actually did this episode, quite a while ago, I think now, most of the panelists on that had barely watched this ever and hadn't watched it for years. They loved Die Hard, you know, Die Hard with a Vengeance, but this was like the poor, you know, redheaded stepchild that was just left, which I found really interesting. I thought, I don't know, like, you don't have to love this film, but I always still feel like it's still good enough to be watched, you know, in a trilogy sort of marathon. So I was just wondering what, Angus, your experiences with this movie, because that was what shocked me, because I was like, kind of like, yeah, I have watched Die Hard the most out of these movies, and maybe probably even Vengeance not far behind, but I probably still watch this almost equally as much. So, yeah.
It definitely is the least watch of the trilogy, of the original trilogy. And I kind of go in cycles with it. Like, I will watch Die Hard fairly regularly. I won't watch it like every Christmas time, but I will watch it.
What? What's wrong with you, man?
Well, you know, it's by my metric, it's not a Christmas movie. But I do watch it quite a bit. And I will watch it, you know, at times of the year that are not Christmas quite regularly. I'll just occasionally throw it on, especially now with everything on streaming. Like, I do own the really nice Blu-ray edition of the first, not the second one, but the first Die Hard. And if I'm planning my day, I'll be like, I'm going to sit down, I'm going to put on the actual disc, and I'm going to get the really beautiful version. But it's on streaming, so occasionally I'll just be like, you know, doing something in the kitchen and be like, I'm just going to throw Die Hard on my laptop while I'm doing this because I just want to watch a bit of Die Hard. So it's, you know, it's one that I'm happy to watch in increments. It's one that I'm happy to kind of, I'm just going to skip ahead to, you know, the last act and just watch the last 25 minutes of this movie. And I don't feel like I'm betraying it because I'm like, I know this movie. I've seen this movie. This one, I go in cycles, and there'll be years where I'm like, if I'm going to watch Die Hard, I got to watch Die Hard 2, you know, as soon afterwards as I can, if not back to back, preferably watch all three. But then I'll kind of do it a couple of times and be like, all right, I don't need to watch Die Hard 2 for a while. I'm okay. And I will, you know, go back to Die Hard with a Vengeance just as a standalone and just be like, I'm just going to check this motherfucker out again. Let's go back, baby. Mm. Or I'll watch, you know, Die Hard and then not watch any others. But this one, yeah, when I, it's almost like I have to forget the movie a little bit to want to go back. Because apart from, you know, the cockpit exploding scene, there is no part of this film in particular that makes me want to rush back. I think, like, William Sadler is great, and I think he does an incredible job in this movie. I just think he has the least interesting villain that was written for him out of the first trilogy. I think, you know, all the actors we talked about, like John Amos, he's brilliant, and William Nathan is a lot of fun. But I think apart from Bruce Willis being John McClane, there's not heaps to bring back. Like, Dennis Franz is a great actor, but his character is written to be a dick. He's not fun. I don't want to seek him out. The traffic control guy is not like a really interesting, compelling foil for Bruce Willis. He's just a good actor doing a good job. Whereas, you know, in Die Hard with a Vengeance and with Die Hard, the first one, you have a whole like crew of characters that are really interesting. You have a whole lineup of setups that are just really fun to watch. In the first one, you've got, you know, just cool action sequence after cool action sequence after cool one-liner. In the third one, you've got that mystery kind of, I was going to say trivia, that mystery riddle element of it that kind of propels you through the film and is really fun to watch all the time. And you've got Samuel Jackson, who is an incredibly good foil for him and someone who really keeps that movie like humming along and takes a lot of the weight off Bruce Willis so that Bruce Willis can just be like a harried, like fucking under the pump John McClane, who is it's him against the world, but he for the first time he has a sidekick who's actually, you know, in the fucking car with him coming along on the ride. It's not Reginald Bell Johnson on the radio. It's a two-man job, and that really lifts it. So there's stuff in the first and the third one to really bring me back. This one, if I forget kind of what's going on a bit, if my brain doesn't give me a rundown of it when I press play, I'll be like, yeah, fuck yeah, Die Hard 2. Let's watch Die Hard 2 again. That's a classic. And then I'll get to the end and be like, it's good. Not as good as I remembered. And every time, it's almost like I keep forgetting it's not as good as I remembered. I'm never like, oh, you got to lower that in your estimation. That's not one of the ones you should be like ranking really high in your brain when it comes to this kind of action genre. And then I forget and I'm like, oh, fuck yeah, Die Hard 2. It's kind of, it's better than it should be. I think it's definitely better than it should be.
Well, given I guess, are we kind of giving it a rating now? Or?
Yeah, I guess we can roll into ratings.
Yeah, because I guess you're kind of giving us a bit of a rating as you go along, so you may as well just hit us between the eyes now.
It's like, it's 2.5, I think, for me. It's a 2.5 star.
Oh, wow.
Because this is one of those sequels where I can't help but stack it up directly against the first one because it does try so hard to be.
Are you rating the first one as like a 5-ish?
Die Hard is a 5-star movie.
So you're saying this is half the film?
I think it's half as good as Die Hard.
Yeah, okay.
And wow. I think it is that half is purely Bruce Willis being great, great John McClane. Like almost, you know, he's John McClane in Die Hard 2. Is so close to being on par with his John McClane in Die Hard. It's almost indistinguishable. I really believe this is the same guy, like a year later, in the same kind of relationship, in the same job, but he's moved. Like all of the stuff that they give us about his character, I buy all of it, and I think he absolutely nails it once again. I just don't think it is as well done of a film, and I think it really comes down to the script. The script is great, but it's half as good a script as Die Hard. Like it's, if this was the first Die Hard movie, I'd be like, oh, that Die Hard movie was pretty good. That's a pretty good movie. I'll check out again. And then like, if you flip him, if this was Die Hard 1 and Die Hard 1 was Die Hard 2, you're like, the first one was pretty good. Holy shit, the sequel, they fucking knocked it out of the park. That was incredible. I wouldn't be like, fuck the first one. The sequel is so good. But you know, this one is the one that came next. Great. Like I have no specific argument against it. Other than it is the second Die Hard movie. You can't help but compare it to the first Die Hard movie. And it's just, in my opinion, it's just half as good. It's just nowhere near being on par for me. I don't know. What about you, Michelle? You back to back them? How do you feel about them?
I feel like I'd give it maybe like a 2 or 2.5. Like I enjoyed it, but I don't think I would bother watching it again. Whereas the first one I could go back and throw on. Like I'm not a big action movie person, so they're probably not necessarily my thing, but they're still enjoyable movies. But yeah, the first one's definitely better. So yeah, probably like 2 stars.
What would you give Die Hard? Out of curiosity, what would you give Die Hard? Given that
maybe like
this is your first time,
3.5.
Sorry, I just threw up in my mouth a bit because I was so disgusted at anyone suggesting that Die Hard is
not a 5-star.
It's fine. It wasn't an emotional reaction. It was a physical one. I just get physically ill when people try and say that Die Hard isn't a perfect movie. But that's fine. That's all right.
Not because it's not enjoyable. It's just not, it's not sort of my vibes, I guess.
That's fine. I get it. I get it. I mean, I don't get it, but I don't either. For the sake of keeping things
they're very much they're boys' movies. Like, not to stereotype everyone, but it's like, people blow
the female characters in both of them are not, I was going to say not well written, but I'd probably say not written. I mean, Bonnie Bedelia's character is definitely better written in the first one.
Mm-hmm.
At least she has some agency in that one. And, you know, there is some interest there in their separation and in her changing the name and her having, you know, a job and something to do in the movie that's not sitting and waiting for John McClane.
Yeah, they're definitely like action, you know, things blown up, guns. Yeah, they're like boy movies. But I also read that it was meant to have more violence and more swearing in number 2. Did you see that?
Yeah, online? Well, I think the traffic control guy, the main guy in the tower, actually went to the writer and was like, there are too many four-letter words in this script.
Yeah, Fred Thompson complained.
Yeah, He's like, it's going to be funny. It's going to be laughable. No one's going to take it seriously because of how much swearing. And he won. They let him not swear. So his character doesn't swear at all. And like, take out all the swear words. That's fine.
Yeah, because I don't mind swearing. Like, we all do it, and we all do it a lot. Probably being Australian, we do it even more. But like, sometimes it's just unnecessary. Like, you just, you know, like I tried to watch Magic Mike, and like, they were swearing too much. And I was like, even though they're all shirtless dudes, I turned it off.
I mean, the sad thing is, by the time you get to Die Hard 4.0, they were trying to make it PG, or PG-13, which meant they were only allowed to say the F word once. And being a Die Hard movie, you can guess what they saved that for. So the rest of the time, John McClane's got to try and fight terrorists and save the world and get shot at and kicked out of windows and essentially be saying like, gee willikers.
Yeah, yippee-ki-yay, mother person.
No, that's the one. That's the one he gets to say. He gets to say that once. He can only say it once. At the end of the movie. Yeah, it's probably worth, now that the first two are fresh in your mind, like I would recommend particularly three just because it is so good.
Is it a Christmas movie? Worth,
like, checking out.
None of them are.
No.
Check out four just so you can see like, oh, there's a bit too much swearing in two, and then watch people in the same situation not swear very deliberately and you realize how weird it is. Yeah. Like if someone is shooting at me, the F-bombs I'm dropping would be so indistinguishable from any other word I was saying.
And in four, they're like, please don't.
One word. Yeah, there's. I think in 4.0, there's lots of like, whoa, 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 whoa. Take it easy, man. They're like, what the fuck do you guys think you're doing, you fucking asshole? You fucking piece of shit. Like,
which is funny because I'm pretty sure a few years after that came out, they did re-release. It wasn't director's cut, but it was kind of like the unrated cut, which obviously they put a bit more swearing back in, but I've never seen a different version.
I mean, the swearing doesn't bother me. You know, watching the young soldier's throat get slit bothered me. That was pretty goddamn gruesome. Watching guy get shot to death, that was gruesome.
But I think Michelle touched on something interesting, though. I think... while we're probably used to swearing and she sort of said, oh, we all do it now. But I don't think back in 1990, I think there were some people that was didn't swear a lot, and people were a bit more civilized maybe, or a bit more, the etiquette was a little bit better. That if you were a proper, not a proper person, but like, again, that role of being, I guess, the manager or up in the control room, I don't necessarily think it's probably believable that he wouldn't swear, he wouldn't cuss as much, and that it's a vulgar thing to be swearing like that. So maybe for that character that completely makes sense, whereas I think now in 2022 a stressed out air controller may be dropping air bombs left, right and center.
Yes. I mean, this guy, the guy who wrote it, Stephen D'Souza,
D'Souza.
He kind of like he walks the line back and forth between films where people would be swearing a hell of a lot and people don't swear at all. Like he did Die Hard 2, he did another 48 Hours, the Nick Nolte.
Lots of swearing. Film,
famously, so many swear words in those movies. Commando, the Schwarzenegger movie, a lot of F bombs in that one. The first 48 Hours he did. What's the other one he did that has lost?
It's funny,
Jack Flash.
I was going to say
The Running Man.
Funny you mentioned Commando, because Die Hard originally was supposed to be Commando 2.
Well, yeah, to the point where the Franco Nero's character, the commander they're trying to rescue, is from the country, I think, Valverde, which is the country, the fictional country that they use in Commando. So they kept that in as like a little wink and a nod. But yeah, then D'Souza kind of, I don't know, he softened. He wrote The Flintstones. He wrote Beverly Hills Cop 3, which is, you know, the one where it stopped being gritty and got funny.
Well,
like the first two were swearing, but the third one was PG. That was a John Landis movie. There's almost no swearing. He did Lara Croft Tomb Raider, Cradle of Life. He did something called Gotta Catch Santa Claus. Like, he really softened his older age. So maybe the F-bomb is a young man's game. I don't know. What's your rating of it, KB? What do you think?
I don't know. I just have the nostalgia for it. Like, I can understand all the points you both have said, where it's definitely no Die Hard. If Die Hard's a 5 out of 5, it's definitely not that. But I always feel like I've always put it on, and maybe that's just I feel bad for it a little bit as well, but I enjoy watching it. It's got its problems, and like you sort of touched on, I feel like there's so much about the first movie, even though there's parts are over the top, a lot of it still within that universe feels believable enough. And off the top of my head, I can't even think of, with the first movie, that many plot holes. Like, no one ever really says about, oh, this plot hole. Whereas this one, there is definitely a lot of plot holes. And like, and you touched on a few where you go, well, that doesn't really add up, and this is way too convenient, and this would never happen, and that sort of stuff. So I think this one does have those issues. Like, it's like so rushed out, they didn't think everything through to get it out, like you said, to make it and put it together and release it on a particular date. Like I said, while, you know, Bruce Willis was hot, let's get a sequel out. But I've always sort of watched it a fair bit. Like I said, I can't remember how many times I've watched it. Maybe I've watched it 40 times or so, but I guess maybe a 3, 3.5, if I'm being generous.
Oh, wow. I thought you were going to go higher than that. I'm surprised.
I probably almost would. Like, I feel like I enjoy all three movies. Like, yeah.
The two of us who have seen all the Die Hard movies keep talking about it like there's only three of them. It's delightful.
Oh, don't worry. And that's
I enjoy all three of them. I think the Die Hard trilogy is great. It's a great trilogy of films that is three films, and I really enjoy the three films they made of Die Hard before they stopped making Die Hard films.
Yeah, well, it's...
How many are there?
Five.
There's five, and there was going to be six.
Yeah.
But Bruce...
We don't talk about them.
Bruce, sadly, is ill and can no longer act, so that went away, but it was in the works. And look, something else that's probably worth saying just before we wrap this up, like the Die Hard movies, it is sort of the one remaining franchise from the 80s that kept going and going and going, and were it not for Bruce Willis's health, there would be a sixth one and potentially even a seventh one before, you know, he got just too old. You know, the only other one who kept kind of going, I guess, was Rambo, but there was a huge break between Rambo 3 and John Rambo, or Last Blood, whatever it wound up being called.
Last Blood, but yes.
But Die Hard kind of kept slowly but surely. We kept slowly but surely getting Die Hard films, which is a rarity. Like, you know, Schwarzenegger doesn't have any franchises like that. Even like Terminator, he stopped being in Terminator movies, basically.
Did he?
Well, he wasn't in 4, and he only had a small part in 5, and then he came back for 6.
I think you want to retract that statement. I don't know if that's entirely
six
true.
Terminators?
Well, there's Terminator, there's Judgment Day, there's Rise of the Machines.
Yep.
Then there's
Salvation. Okay.
Salvation. Yeah. So he's got like a tiny cameo.
And that, I don't even think that was him at all. That would have been just totally CGI.
And then Genesis.
Yeah, he's in Genesis.
But he doesn't have a very big part, does he?
Yeah.
Does he?
He's in it a fair bit, yeah.
I can't remember. I know he's in Dark Fate, but Dark Fate was kind of, they were like, hey, remember those movies no one really enjoyed? Forget about them. They didn't happen.
We're going to
retcon, baby. We're jumping on board the retcon wagon. But even that, like the Terminator movie, aren't really going. That's something else that we got to talk about one day. Is the law of diminishing returns on Terminator movies and Alien movies? How they keep making them, but no one
and Predator
is enjoying them. And well, I mean, Prey kind of reset the clock a bit. Everyone seemed to enjoy Prey, but you know, the Die Hard movies definitely people are like, huh? And then the Die Hard, okay, but no one was like absolutely hating on them. The Die Hard. Diehards were like, yeah, man, let's do it.
Yippee-ki-yay.
Yeah, and like Bruce Willis still name above the title, face on the poster, kind of the Die Hard movies are him. In fact, there's that famous quote that Kevin Smith did when he was promoting a book a few years back, because he was in Die Hard 4.0, and then there was some script issues on one of the days where his character has a chair, because he's a hacker. And there was this fancy chair the director was really excited about that they got set up in this really cool way. And then John McClane comes in and walks over and, you know, needs the hacker to help him. So he has to kind of swallow his pride a little bit and accept that this fat, greasy mama's boy who lives in a basement has the one up on him, because that movie's all about technology. And Bruce Willis was like, no, he has to come to me. And they're like, no, because the shot is all set up over there and the chair is like the focus of the shot. And like, it's kind of a gag how the chair works. So he has to be sitting in the chair and you like the stairs from the door to the chair. So you have to come down. He's like, no, he has to come to me. And they're like, no, he's like, John McClane would never walk over to that guy. He has to come to me. And then like walked off set and wouldn't do it. So they had to rewrite the set on the script on the spot. And everyone was like freaking out. And the screenwriter was like, ugh! And Kevin Smith was kind of hanging out in his trailer and was like, yeah, I mean, can I help at all? I am a writer as well. And the screenwriter was like, yeah, I honestly don't care anymore. I'm like the fourth screenwriter in this movie. You go for it. So he wrote it up and Bruce Willis read it and was like, I really like this. And then the studio called up and was like, no, we're not doing this. Go and shoot the scene the way it's written. We're not paying this guy to rewrite the scene because we have to pay him now as a writer if you do that. We also have to reset the whole, we lose like the day. Do it. We're not doing this. And the famous kind of quote that Kevin Smith tells is like, Bruce Willis said, well, let me ask you something. Who's your second choice to play John McClane? And then there was silence. And he went, I thought so, and hung up. And then said to Kevin Smith, write the scene however you want. Which, I mean, is kind of badass. But also, when you know how hard it is to get movies made, he's like, oh, man, you arrogant fuck. You just ruined so many people's days. But he's right. Like, Die Hard is John McClane. John McClane is Bruce Willis. Mm-hmm. And there is no doubt that he created one of the ultimate film characters over the five films he got to play in. He definitely, like I said, he definitely crushes it in this movie. There's nothing bad I can think to say about Bruce Willis as John McClane in this movie. He knocks it out of the park. It's just everything else doesn't follow him, which, you know, it happens. It's kind of, it's weird. Like, none of us are super, like, Cable, you love it, but you're saying in yourself it's a nostalgia. It's kind of weird to, like, get the end of Talking About a Film, like, none of us are super high on it. None of us are like, this movie.
Oh, I'm going to go put it on now.
All of us are still like, pretty good. Like, I like it. It's just, you know, you can't call an apple a pear. Like, this thing is an amazing movie, but pretty good movie. I'll watch it multiple more times. I don't know how, you said you've watched it like 40. I reckon I'd be under 20, I think, if I've watched it. I definitely like watched it a lot when I was younger.
It's definitely one that
it's taken off pretty hard.
Yeah, it's definitely one that's, again, tapered off, like you said, is as you get older and you've got other movies to watch and less time, you don't necessarily go back to the world. There's a lot of movies from the late 90s and early sort of 2000s and the I guess the start of the DVD era that I had and probably could have watched those movies 20 times in 2 or 3 years and then have never seen since. So that's not one of them.
I was saying, I wish like I did have a tally. I'm like, if somebody being, if you know, the watcher could come down and tell me exactly how many times I've watched a movie, I'd like to know. Because there is a chance that I've watched Die Hard with a Vengeance more than Die Hard, just because there was a really solid period when that came out on VHS that it was almost never not in my house. And I was watching it like almost daily for a long time there. Because that came out like when I was really getting to movies. Like Die Hard came out when I was a kid. So that was the one that was out when I was old enough to be like really getting to it.
Yeah, well, that was the first one I was able to see in the cinemas as well. So that's, I guess I've got the nostalgia.
I did see in the cinemas. Oh my God. Yeah, you're right. And that definitely would have had an impact. And then any movie I saw in the cinemas was amazing in my estimation.
Crazily enough, it was one of those chance encounters, but I happened to be at a shopping center. I was with mum and ran into some friends who they were going to see it. And mum goes, oh, do you want to go with your friends to go to movies? And I'm like, mum would never let me. Normally that mum wouldn't let me see even like Die Hard. She's like, oh, am I violent? But it was kind of like, nah, go with your friends. I'm like, oh, this is the best day ever. I'm like, well, what happened to mum?
Mum had shit to do that day. She was like, get rid of it. I've got so much. He's pissing me off. Take him.
Maybe. Yeah, maybe.
Take him to Texas Chainsaw Massacre for all I care. Get out of my hair.
Yeah, so yeah, I went and saw Die Hard with the Vengeance. So, I mean, seeing it on the big screen was also a big deal. So
the trailer, like with all the trailers, they kind of pump Ode to Joy. But with that one, I feel like they put it into overdrive. And I remember like going to the cinema and seeing the trailer, like in the full Dolby surrounds. I was like, oh, man. So the trailer alone is so good. Oh, I love that Die Hard trilogy they only made three movies of before they stopped making Die Hard movies. So good. Such a good trilogy. That and Indiana Jones, two of the best trilogies ever that they never made any more movies of.
Mm-hmm.
And Scream. Great. Scream. 1, 2, and 3.
No, there's 4 Scream movies.
No, there's not.
There's 4 and it really comes home strong with that last one that they made.
Oh, I thought it was just 1, 2, 4. I thought They accidentally skipped three for some shit.
Look, we've talked about this podcast before. I will not endure any Scream 3 hate on this podcast. That is a great film, and we all loved it when it came out. We all love it now, and there'll be no pretending. All right? Scream 3 is awesome.
Scream 3 is awesome. It's better than Scream 4.
I guess on that note, not all sequels suck.
Yippee-ki-yay, Merry Christmas. You Die Hard by Guy's Night. We're gonna die.